Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide because we're so full of chaos and madness. You lose a sense of humour, you go freaking nuts. Randall Carlson has not turned up just yet, about 5 to 10 minutes away. So we should be connecting him relatively shortly. Now, we do want to get into the, well, at least I wanted to. I was thinking about this over the break, guys. What effect does it have on your spirituality, knowing codes and sacred geometry and all of those kind of things? Because when it's no longer part of belief, when there's actually a measurement, a scientific sort of mathematical breakdown of the way things are, how does that affect, you know, belief structures and spirituality, as it were? Scott, what do you reckon?
Well, I think that we traditionally sort of link spirituality and religion, and more recently people have been separating that out and saying they're spiritual, not religious. But our culture has kind of a, almost like it's put a ceiling on spirituality sort of at the mythic level of consciousness. But I think that spirituality carries all the way up and all the way down, so there is a rational form of spirituality. There is a trans-rational form of spirituality. We just don't see great examples of that in our culture because our culture is coming from the mythic or pre-rational or traditional conception of spirituality, primarily when we're thinking about religion. But a lot of the numbers that I put forth in my movies and book are kind of an attempt to get more at a rational kind of spirituality, using all of these, things that you need to understand algebra a little bit. You need to understand at least, making ratios and, taking scientific measurements and being very accurate and precise and, doing all of that allows you to use some of the rational faculties of our mind. And I think that when we get into these realms of synchronicity and why are these numbers all mysteriously perfect, I think it leads us sort of more in the spiritual realm. At least that's where it takes me, rather than sort of the conspiratorial realm as much, although I'm not denying that conspiracies exist because they certainly do. But I'm just saying that these things get me thinking more in a state of awe and wonder, and almost what you would think of as a religious feeling I get when I look at these numbers. But it's done with a rational understanding rather than just a story about it. Does that make any sense?
It does, and it reminds me of my friend Jonathan Eisen does this magazine, Uncensored magazine from uncensored.co.nz. And he told me once, Vinny, religion and spirituality are mutually exclusive.
Well,
and I was thinking about this before,
but I think that we need to sort of blow the doors open on religion and allow it to carry us forward into these higher realms that involve, rationality and sensitivity and in some areas that just aren't there in the angry God of the Old Testament, for example. Spirituality should grow out of religion in the ideal world, but when people are fixed with religious ideas that are clearly not even rational, we sort of have to leave it behind and just keep moving forward anyway for our own sanity. And then that's when we have this split that happens there. But I don't think that split is healthy, basically. I think we need to somehow heal that or find a bridge to allow us to go from the ethnocentric God to one that's more universal. Does that make sense?
Well, kind of taking belief and logic and rationale and mathematics and making them one so that you can create a complete person who's both spiritual and rational. Is that what you're talking about?
That's right. That would be a step in the right direction, is to embrace rationality and being able to ask questions and find answers that aren't just, this is what you must believe, but to keep seeking and asking better and better questions. Exactly.
Mm. And Cameron, you had something to add to this. We can't hear you, bro. You're muted. Still can't hear you.
Maybe we lost him.
How about now? How about now? Is that better?
Yeah.
Sorry. Well, you know, it seems that embedded within a lot of these sacred texts are these exact same numbers we're discussing. And so it's almost as though they were sheltered through the Kali Yuga age to preserve and protect this, so at the appropriate moment, people who had the inclination to be spiritual, to want to develop a moral compass and serve others and be charitable, that they could have this revelation.
That's a great point, Cameron. Just realizing that these numbers are embedded in the religious structures as well.
I believe we're back. Sorry about that. Now, do we have Scott? Are you still there? Okay. AFR, you're going to have to reconnect Scott. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, my Skype just kind of dropped out. I've got some technical issues going on with the place I'm in. I really need to move to somewhere with a better connection. All right. So you can turn your webcam back on now, Cameron, as well. All right. Whew. It's a bit frustrating. Okay. So sorry about this, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a real difficult day for all. Where were we? We were talking about religion and spirituality and all of that kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah, are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm back on. Yeah, well, basically, it's interesting to think about the enormous effort that went into encoding these ratios, harmonic ratios, into temple complexes all over the planet, a lot of times simultaneously. You know, within the same century. And here we are now rediscovering them. So it's like an intentional time capsule of sorts. And I think people who have the inclination to seek God, sometimes they become waylaid by orthodoxy, and they don't realize that they are being mind controlled. So there's this negative aspect of religious revelation. You know, you can use it to ensnare someone's consciousness if you are, you know, say, performing dark shamanism. So it could be that what's going to happen here is more and more people who have been in one order or a certain style of religious practice will realize that there's this deeper aspect that's hidden within the sacred text that they've grown up with, and that will help liberate them overall. And that could happen within the same period, so we could see a new renaissance in terms of spiritual cultivation mixed with the discipline or discipleship of those who truly want to bring heaven and earth together.
You know, it didn't occur to me until just when you say that the word disciple comes from the word discipline.
Right. It's funny how that even the word rational is based in ratio. And so it's like this entire education of the spirit has been withheld from us deliberately on multiple levels. Not and Scott is right, not just to be conspiratorial, but It does seem that somehow, maybe it's just the effect of the Kali Yuga on the communal mind, and that's just something that we have to weather, and it's just part of this larger process that we're remembering. But it is there, and it does unlock aspects of words we think we understand.
Yeah. Now, we're not sure if Scott's there. Scott, you're not back, are you? No. Okay, well, we've got a caller on the line there who's been waiting patiently for pretty much the entire show. We're just going to unmute him and bring him up. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, wonderful.
Hey, Nathan.
Hey, guys, how you doing? I just... What's that?
I said you're very patient.
Who's my what?
Hello? I said you're very, you are very patient.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm a landscaper, so I get to work and mow lawns and listen to you, to Vinny, all day long. Well, when he's on. But anyways, yeah, no, you guys are talking about stuff right up my alley, at least my father's alley. The jerk, he won't answer the phone for me. And he's written this trilogy that he's trying to get published right now called The Sun Road Way. And unfortunately, you know, he has a website called thesunroadway.com. I just sent you guys an email on your website, so hopefully that'll go through. It's got my site and his site. And maybe you guys could help me persuade him to kind of come back to, I don't know, communicating and collaborating with maybe even you guys and his son, you know. That'd be nice. But anyways, he's all about the spider grandmother and the Hopi mythology, ley lines. And have you guys heard of the Catalan Atlas?
No.
I've not heard of the Catalan Atlas.
Well, that is something you could just, Catalan Atlas. You could check that out, you know, just like Google image that. And it's a really interesting old style map. And he's claiming that he's got kind of the complete updated version. Like I guess he's saying that it's been a while since I've been able to talk to the jerk, but I guess he's saying that he's got the complete version of it, and he's figured out some keys to the system. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's his ego or what, but you know, he wants to pass on this book as kind of like the legacy to his offspring. And I'm seeing this system. He's got the whole world. You know that movie, The Beautiful Mind? The guy, all the ones. That's my dad. Okay, my old family thinks he's crazy. But there is really a system going on here. And everywhere I turn, I'm seeing more and more people start to realize this. And anyways, I see a practical application.
Nathan, that's cool, man. And if you've sent us those emails, we should be able to get to that and collaborate with your dad and get to it, bro. Unfortunately, you kind of seem to be going off on a bit
nice.
Of it. Yeah, man. And now we have Randall Carlson coming us. And Nathan, thank you for your call. So Randall.
He's almost here. He's
I see him in the frame, yo.
Randall, you ready to go on air?
Sure.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
I'm passing the headphones.
Hello? Hello?
Hello, Randall. How are you, man?
Vinny, yes. I'm doing much better now.
How was that traffic?
Was horrible.
Yeah.
I had to run over a few pedestrians to get here, but hey. And a couple of puppy dogs, but, you know, it's all for the greater glory, right?
If you want to make an omelet, you got to break some puppies.
That's the deal, yeah. You've got to squash some puppies.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we've got about 60 seconds before we're coming to break, Randall. And so just hang back for a few minutes there. And we're going to bring back in Scott Onstott as well. And we're going to really kind of get a discussion going, because that was ultimately what I really wanted out of this particular episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, was to have a conversation between Randall and Scott, because these are two of the, basically some of the most brilliant minds really in the game. And it occurs to me as well that if you're going to have two brilliant minds in the room together, they form some kind of opinion through the conversation that basically makes them both smarter. And if you happen to be listening to the conversation, you get a little smarter as well. So that's hopefully what we're going to do after the break, is have a conversation between Randall Carlson from SacredGeometryInternational.com and Scott Onstott as well, to hopefully get themselves into a frenzy and enlighten the rest of the listeners as well as myself. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinny Eastwood Show. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show. My very special guests are Scott Onstott and Randall Carlson. So Randall just asked us over the break, Scott, could I recap in 15 seconds what we've been talking about? And I said, nah, bro, I can't, eh? Take us about an hour and a half. But anyway, what I wanted to do is just have a kind of a conversation between Randall and Scott. And I think the last thing we were talking about was how knowing about measurements and geometry and mathematics and things of that nature affects your perspective on spirituality and what it actually is. Randall, what would your opinion be?
On the matter of... That's the kind of thing I should ponder for a minute. But in the instance of interest of time here, I'll say that measurement clearly relates to geometry. And one of the things that I think that we find when we begin to study measurement is that it was held in very high regard by ancient cultures. And in fact, when we think about the, I may have even gotten this from Scott. The idea that a ruler is an implement of measure, right? But it is also the ruler of the kingdom, right? And the idea was is that the ruler, the measuring stick, the cubit, the rod, the staff was an implement of power that the king was able to wield. And in a sense, it was. In my business as a builder, I certainly know the importance of good measure. And, the Bible, plus a lot of other spiritual writings, are full of references to the importance of good measure. But once we get into the specifics of it, what we discover is that all throughout the ancient world, there seems to be a whole set of interconnections amongst all these various units of measurement, and they all can be synthesized into a systematic whole through the medium of geometry. So, in many of the visionary writings of the Bible, the prophecies and so forth, what do we find? That the prophet is confronted by a man, sometimes an angel, who holds a measuring line or a measuring rod in his hand. And I think part of the reason for that is because we have this idea of dynamic symmetry infused throughout all of the material universe, and it's reflected of patterns that perhaps we can't see visibly, but are reflected through the nature of space and time. Because as we've talked about before, one of the things that interests me is how we apply these patterns, if you will, to the measurement of time as well as space. So something that's intrigued me for many years is temporal periodicities, and how, we tend to look at time in the modern context is basically purely a linear phenomenon. And I think that comes from sort of the Judeo-Christian concept that there was a definite point of creation, and then there will be a final moment of destruction, it's called Judgment Day or whatever. And so there's a beginning and an end, and it's proceeding forward in this linear fashion, whereas in the ancient models of time, it was cyclical, and there were cycles within cycles, smaller cycles, just as our daily cycle is subsumed within the larger cycle of the year. The year was conceived as being contained within larger cycles, and those in turn in larger cycles. And so we've inherited this concept of the great year, which I consider to be the model of all prophecy, because, basically the prophet is the one who was able to take the long view. I used the analogy with somebody earlier today that, here in in Georgia. It's now, you know, 2nd of May. And if your memory only went back for 2 weeks, you would have a concept of the way the world was, right? And you wouldn't understand the concept of winter, right? You wouldn't understand, or if your entire framework of reference was limited to only July for 1 month, and your memory didn't go past that, you wouldn't have a concept of winter. But someone who had a longer view, whose memory went back a full year, would understand the cyclic nature of time, and by knowing what had transpired in the past, one can make intelligent predictions about what is likely to transpire in the future. And I tend to think that that's the basis of prophecy, is that you have access to this domain of information about the longer, the larger cycles of change. And, you know, we have a scientific model. Geologists look at it and have now decided that there are, seems to be, cycles of change. You know, in the last 2.6 million years, roughly, we've oscillated back and forth between glacial and interglacial ages. You know, astronomers look at the larger celestial domain around us and see that everything is orbiting and everything has a periodicity to it. You know, looking at on atomic and molecular frequencies, it appears that there's a cyclic nature to the thing. Now, I think that what we might be approaching here is the idea that there is a kind of a harmonic resonance between all these domains of scale, so that things are vibrating on a smaller... For example, the distance between an electron and the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, if you scale that up, it would be roughly the distance from the sun to the Oort cloud, which is the cloud of comets that surrounds the sun. So...
Can I offer something here?
Of course.
All right, I was just thinking as you're saying this, have you ever seen those mechanical models of the solar system? You know, Pluto's got its specific orbit and it runs around at a certain rate, yes. And Earth goes around at a certain, you know,
yes,
and so they're all going out of control, sort of, it seems like, but every now and again they align. And I was just thinking about that as an analogy for, say, human existence. Let's say there's certain aspects of human culture and human life that go round and then come back again, and occasionally there's big alignments where everything's all happening at once. And a lot of people have said that we're kind of living in that time of alignment, like the potential energy for both good and evil is at its highest that it's really ever been.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do seem to be living in accelerated times. I mean, you know, we can look at large periods of history and see that for the majority of the human race within recorded history, the world that they, you know, when they reached their old age and the world that they passed away from wasn't a whole lot different from the world that they were born into. And, you know, for the majority of the human population, typically they lived their lives within, you know, a 10 to 20 mile radius of where they were born. And the world didn't change much. Well, of course, there have been these episodes of concentrated change, obviously, and we're certainly in one right now. I mean, you know, I mean, I will always recall my grandfather telling me that, you know, well, when I was a little boy, there were no airplanes. We hadn't taken to the air yet, you know. And, of course, I came along in the mid-century, and there was no space. We had no space program, you know, when I was a little kid. We had no satellites, you know. Now, when we think about what satellites, the fact, they're, you know, the fact that you're sitting here in New Zealand, and I'm up here in the southeastern United States, talking to each other real time and looking at each other, I mean, this was inconceivable 40 and 50 years ago. So, I mean, clearly the pace of change has accelerated from what it was.
And when I was a little kid, Randall, we didn't have personal computers. So that's, you know, in my lifetime, obviously, we have this wonderful invention, Skype, that allows us to connect all across the planet. And I don't think we even understand the implications of that yet. Like, what is that really going to do for us? When,
oh, you know, exactly.
You know, in the long term.
I wanted to point something out. Could I just say one thing before you continue, Scott? Humanity kind of needs to evolve with the technology, and I think what happens is when the technology comes into play, it forces an evolutionary change in how we act and how we communicate and how we build our society, doesn't it?
Yes. Randall agrees.
I agree.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, Scott, you were saying?
Oh, just that I recently went to Venice, and there's a beautiful clock there in St. Mark's Square that it's a 24-hour dial, and it has the all the zodiac constellations, so you can see where the sun is, in which sign, at what time of day, and it also tracks the movement of the moon through the zodiac. And I just thought that was brilliant because it gives everybody there in Venice the notion of cyclical time, because the arm on the clock basically shows you where you are in Earth's rotation, and it ties you in with the influences of the planets and the whole astrology. And so I thought that was a really interesting way of depicting time. It emphasizes the interconnection with the solar system and the movement of the Earth, which is something that has sort of been forgotten and broken with digital watches and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The clock is a symbol to me. The clock with the 12 hours on it is a symbol for the year with the 12 months and the great year with the 12 ages. I don't ever look at a clock where I'm not reminded of, you know, the grander cycles that have the same tempo, but on a much larger scale. Yes, very much.
That was something we talked about earlier in the show, Randall, is how life is built upon life infinitely up in scale and infinitely down in scale, just like geometry is built upon geometry infinitely up in scale and down in scale.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, all the structures of the atoms have similar structures to the solar system, and the solar system's got similar structure to the greater galaxy, and so on,
yes,
and so forth.
Yeah, I don't know if you caught that analogy that I used between the electron and the outer shell of the that occupies the outer shell relative to the nucleus. But that to me is a very interesting relationship, because, you know, certainly when we talk about the solar system, most people think of, you know, out to the outer planets, but it actually extends much, much further than that and includes this gigantic zone of cometary material that was left over from the creation of the solar system. And it would appear now that this zone of material, the cometary material, has played a very profound role in the evolution of life on this planet. You've probably heard of the emerging science of exobiology, which is basically theorizing that life did not actually originate on Earth, but originated elsewhere in the universe and was delivered to this planet by, most likely, the most effective instrument for the delivery of life would be comets. And the Oort cloud is a shell of comets that surrounds our solar system out to several light years, almost halfway to the nearest star systems, which are about 4.3 light years away. And then within the Oort cloud, you have the Kuiper disk, or Kuiper belt, which is another zone of comets, which lies more or less in the plane of the planets. But all the Kuiper disk and the Oort cloud are both essential parts of the whole solar system. And we can't talk about the solar system without realizing that there's this outer zone of matter and energy that's going on. And the Oort cloud can be affected by things, modulated by things that are on the galactic level, so that galactic perturbations can cause dislodging of the Oort cloud comets, which are in a quasi-stable state, and send them on an inward journey where they will come in and pass the zone of the planets and eventually approach the sun. And likewise, with the Kuiper disk, the inner zone of the Kuiper disk will be perturbed by conjunctions of the large outer planets, which can send comets careening into the inner solar system, where they would then become potentially Earth crossers and could affect life on Earth, either through direct impacts or by littering the inner solar system with the byproducts of their disintegration. And because of the fact that the perturbations of the comets are governed by the tempo of the planetary orbits, there could be right there the suggestion of a synchrony between the periodicities of the planets and the delivery schedule of comets to the inner solar system, where they can basically do their work of affecting evolution.
So there's an analogy I thought of when you're discussing that, Randall, of how a comet could bring the building blocks of life to the planet. And it's very much like a sperm bringing the code to the egg.
Yes, it's an incredible metaphor there, because there's a lot of similarities, even just the visual appearance. But also, in a way, you know, when the spermatozoan enters the egg, there's a response in the egg that basically, and I'm not sure how the biology of this works, but it prevents the further incursion of other spermatozoan. And I think that, in effect, we are sort of, humans could possibly be like the sort of the biological counterpart, in that we could provide a planetary defense system. But I think that basically, okay, if there are planets throughout the galaxy, the halfway mark of a planet would essentially be when life has evolved to the point where it could actually leave the host planet. And I sort of look at that right now, that planet Earth is at the halfway point, because for hundreds of millions of years, planet has been subject and vulnerable to these sweeping cosmic destructions imposed upon the planet from outside the cosmic domain. And unlike the dinosaurs, we humans now can actually do something to prevent that further process from occurring, the mass extinctions and the devastation of habitat and so forth that has occurred throughout the history of the planet. And that could, in the long run, be our redemption.
You know, ironically, Randall, I think that actually we're accelerating our extinction rather than developing the ability to prevent it in a lot of ways. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Randall Carlson and Scott Onstott are my guests. Back in a minute.
Never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say
ladies and gentlemen, it's the final segment here with Randall Carlson and Scott Onstott. I was just thinking about that interesting analogy of the sperm and the egg as a comet hitting the Earth, and what do astrologers believe, or who is it that believes that the movement of planets affects your mind, your consciousness, or your life in some way? And I was just thinking about it, these comets. With the movement of a comet, even if it doesn't hit Earth, I wonder if that would affect human consciousness as well. You know, free radicals, as it were. I don't know. Maybe being a rogue is its own benefit.
I think it would have a more subtle influence than the larger planetary bodies, just because of it doesn't have the mass compared to the other planets.
Mass of a comet nucleus is minuscule compared to the mass of a planet. However, comets do have the ability to come very close to the Earth, obviously much closer than any of the planets do. But, you know, the influence of comet could also be in the fact that when they come in, what they do, when they're out there in deep space, they're essentially in hibernation. They're in deep freeze. And once they're dislodged from that repository, whether it's the Kuiper disk or the Oort cloud, and they come into the solar system, they activate. They sort of come out of their hibernation, they become active, and then they begin to undergo a life cycle. And essentially what they do is they, over a given number of orbits, usually between the Sun and Jupiter, they will disintegrate. And it's in the disintegration of the comet. I don't know if you can recall Shoemaker-Levy 9, which was discovered in a grazing pass around Jupiter back in 1996, March of 1996, and it made an orbit around the Sun, and in the course of orbiting between Jupiter and the Sun, it split into 21 pieces, and those 21 pieces then collided with Jupiter in I believe it was in the first week of July of 1995, 94, 94, right.
I think the perturbations on Jupiter were larger than the Earth.
Yes, right. The effects in the Jupiter, the Jovian atmosphere, were larger than the entire planet Earth itself. Now, what we saw there was essentially like the first stage in the disintegration of a comet. Had it made several more orbits before it fell into Jupiter, those 21 pieces could have become hundreds of pieces, and those hundreds of pieces could have become literally millions of pieces. And whenever we have a meteor shower, remember, when we have a meteor shower, whether it's like the most recent one, the Lyrids, or whether it's the Perseids, the Leonids of November, the Draconids, those are all remnants of comets that have come in and made their orbits around the inner solar system and have disintegrated, leaving a stream of cosmic material in their wake. That cosmic material can be all the way from very fine dust up to, you know, kilometer-sized objects with everything in between. The object that blew up over Siberia in 1908, I think we touched briefly on that in our last conversation, the Tunguska event of 1908, June of 1908. Are you familiar with that, Vinny? Tunguska,
no.
there was a massive multi-megaton, 15 to 20 megaton explosion over Siberia in the year 1908, and it blew down over 800 square miles, which is about 2,000 square kilometers of old-growth taiga forest. It was just devastating to the region. And that was a chunk, almost certainly a chunk of Comet Encke, which was, the piece was roughly 100 to 150 feet in diameter. And when something like that enters the atmosphere, moving at, you know, between 20 and 30 miles per second, it releases energy equivalent to a large nuclear bomb. You, of course, remember the thing that happened in mid-February with the small piece of space debris blowing up over the Russian city, right? You remember that?
I did see those
months ago. Okay, and you remember that on the same day what happened? There was also a close flyby of a small asteroid passing 17,200 miles from the Earth, which is within orbit of a lot of our satellites. Well, within the 3 weeks before and after that, there were eight flybys of asteroids. Eight. There was like a cluster of them. And what we're beginning to realize now as we begin to learn more about the astronomical domain is that it's much more densely populated than anybody was even imagining a generation or two ago. And at the same time, we're realizing that the solar system is densely populated with stuff. We're also realizing that the Earth has been impacted by this stuff more times than we can even begin to count. And all you need to do, Vinny, or any listeners out there, one of the things that I always tell people to do is get a good pair of binoculars on a clear night when there's a full moon and go out and spend some time looking at the moon through the binoculars. And what you basically see is the surface of a body, a celestial body, whose entire face is scarred with hundreds of thousands of impact events. Then ponder the fact that our Earth is likely to be around 80 times more susceptible to cosmic impacts than the moon. And then you'll realize that perhaps impacts of things from space has been at this point, the underappreciated influence in evolutionary history on this planet.
Wouldn't it be great to develop some sort of massive project to protect the Earth from these possible cometary impacts from space?
Well, see, this is what I was trying to squeeze in just before the last break. I was saying that perhaps human redemption lies in the fact that, number one, realizing that as much damage as we have caused, I hate to say this, but putting it in perspective, it's minuscule compared to the terrestrial damage that's been caused by nature itself. Because during the height of the Cold War, when the Soviet and U.S. arsenals, we were staring eyeball to eyeball, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and coming up into the 70s, the total megatonnage in the global nuclear arsenals was around 10,000 megatons. And I don't think anybody would argue that had we unleashed an all-out thermonuclear war at the peak of the Cold War, it wouldn't have been utterly devastating to our planet, to its environment, to its ecology, to the biological realm as well as the social realm. Okay, 10,000 megatons, right? Even a small asteroid striking the Earth would be measured in hundreds of thousands or millions of megatons of energy released into the biosphere. And this has happened, again, more times than we can even begin to account. And it's happened on the large scale and affected life, certainly by causing mass extinctions and resetting of the ecological clock, and it has almost certainly been a major factor in terminating previous cultures. I mean, there's evidence now that the Bronze Age collapse of about 43 to 4400 years ago was also accompanied by a major environmental downturn and the influx of cosmic material into the biosphere. There's evidence growing that the Dark Ages were triggered by an influx of cosmic material, possibly even an asteroid impact into the North Sea that caused a global downturn that lasted about a decade. Excuse me. If you go back to if you go and reference the dendrochronological studies, the tree ring studies that have been done, they basically show that between the period 536 and 545 AD, for almost a decade, forest growth in the northern hemisphere almost came to a stop. And the planet was literally cold and dark for about 10 years. It was devastated agriculture. It caused malnutrition, which led to and eventually famine. Famine led to weakened immune systems. And then in 542 AD, you had the onset of the Justinian Plague that wiped out a third of the population of Europe. And all of this may have been ultimately triggered by the incursion of cosmic material. And what we're realizing now is that this may have been a much, much bigger factor throughout both human history and planetary history than anybody had previously appreciated, you know, a generation ago.
So, Randall, but, I want to ask you, shouldn't we develop not only some kind of interplanetary Star Wars system that deflects or protects us from these comets, but in addition, we should make some kind of permanent monument, somewhat like the Great Pyramid, that encodes the sum total of our knowledge, sort of as an insurance policy, so that if we do get mostly wiped out, the people who do survive will be able to recover a modern civilization relatively quickly.
Yes, I sort of consider that as the backup plan, the plan B. To me, the preferred plan, plan A, is what is the first option you mentioned. That we have it within our technological means now to basically more or less secure this planet against those kinds of things, those kinds of events, probably within a decade. In fact, I think we're probably closer to achieving that right now than we were to putting a man on the moon in 1960. And creating, it's actually was suggested by somebody that we set up a data bank on the moon and offload everything up there as a ultimate backup for all of our systems here on Earth.
To have an off-site backup, the ultimate off-site backup.
An off-planet backup. But you see, if we had stayed on course from the days of the Apollo program, you know, we lost so much momentum in the 70s. I mean, we squandered so much money on the Vietnam War that there was nothing left over for the space program. And so, you know, it was politically driven, you know, the race between the U.S. and the Soviets. There was a lot of interesting consequences of that have actually turned out to be a good thing for you know, civilization on the planet. But, you know, NASA had plans for the first manned mission to Mars to take place in the mid-80s. You know, the permanent base on the moon by the end of the 70s, independent, free-floating colonies in space by the mid-90s.
But now that the space shuttles are done and government funding is drying up, it seems like it has to come from private enterprise. Maybe if everyone had to pledge $1 or 1 euro or something, if a system protected us from just one asteroid, then, you know, the company would make presumably $7 billion, so there'd be quite an economic incentive to, you know, protect the whole planet from incursions of comets.
Well, yes. You know, guys, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the live broadcast. Scott, if you're okay, I'll give you a ring back and we'll connect Randall up as well for an extended interview that we'll put up on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Are you okay with that, Scott?
I'm good with that.
All right, cool. We'll call you back in a minute. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you again sometime at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.